through 3.
Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of House Committee on Revenue, Monday, June 3rd. We will start with the work sessions and have the informational meeting at the end. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 3324.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 3324 exempts funds collected through third-party vendors for payments received for electric vehicle charging stations, and it's exempting these funds from public gift laws. Currently, the way that this charge is processed is that the user pays the fee at the station, a company holds on to that fee, and then remits the fees to the state. And something about that setup is violating public gift laws currently. There is a dash one amendment, which creates a sunset day for this exemption.
Thank you. And committee, I had asked for and suggested an amendment with a sunset date because I was concerned about having basically a one-off carve-out for a specific industry sector, feeling that it was more appropriate to tackle the problem of these vendor payments more broadly rather than one industry or one type of business at a time. And the purpose of the amendment would be to have a sunset, and I would hope provide the incentive for a conversation with the Treasury about a more general solution to this problem. And I think I'll make a statement now, what I had in mind generally. I really appreciate the Treasurer's Office studying and making the recommendations that they have. I appreciate their careful and constant watch over public funds, and that's what this bill is about, to protect public funds that are at some point not necessarily deposited. Deposited in a regulated financial institution. The issues that the Treasurer's Office has identified in the next bill to try to work with different types of organizations and payment methods, it didn't seem like they were addressing the need immediately for this particular business and this particular industry. And I am hoping that a broader solution, something like what we're seeing in 2390, the next bill, would be enough to take care of the issues that this one bill is trying to tackle, if that makes sense. We're doing a small thing. I think we need a big solution. So if you like the idea of a sunset, you would want to move the amendment in. And if you think it's fine to consider the bill in its original form, that's the version that you would want. Yes, Representative Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've read the dash one amendment, and it doesn't say sunset in there. It says not operable till January 2nd, 2022.
I think I can provide some clarification here. Yes. This is a double amend, I believe is the way that it's typically referred to. So the bill itself creates this exemption, and then the amendment, even though it doesn't seem like a sunset, removes that exemption, effective on the sunset date.
Gotcha. It's a double negative.
Okay.
I can try to explain it again if that will help.
I'm not getting this one, so.
I don't not get that.
Yeah.
No.
So the bill as introduced creates this exemption, and what is the dash one amendment removes the exemption. And so when we got the amendment in, I had a similar question, which was, why doesn't it just say we sunset on this date? but this is the, I guess, method of removing the exemption from law, and that sunset would take place on January 2nd, 2022.
Okay.
Is there, Mr. Alanak, do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. This kind of sunset usually provokes this kind of confusion. The way it works is that the initial bill adds the one language, and so then that's effective next year. And then what the amendment does is section two, and Austin, if you could scroll down a little bit. So you can see where on lines 9 and 10, it removes that language. And then section three says that section two is operative January 2nd, 2022. So we're just going to have two versions of that statute. So this, the version without it becomes effective in 2022. So that's that style of sunset.
Okay. You couldn't just write it sunsetted on this date. It would have been a hell of a lot better. So. I'm from Eastern Oregon. You had to humor me at times.
I'm ready for any sort of motion you might want to make. Well, almost any.
Chair Nathanson, I move the Dash One Amendment be adopted into HB 3324.
Representative Marsh moves the Dash One Amendment be adopted into House Bill 3324. Discussion? Objections? Motion passes.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 3324 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Marsh moves House Bill 3324 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I felt like I should have voted no twice to get to yes.
Oh, gee. I don't know where. 3324. I don't have the carrier marked on here. Hang on a second.
Madam Chair, I'm probably not the best carrier for this bill.
I think, yeah. Representative Marsh?
Sure.
Thank you. The carrier will be Representative Marsh. We are completed with House Bill 3324, closing that work session. House Bill 2390, work session.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 2390, the Dash 2 amendment replaces the bill, so I'll discuss that amendment. It is adds to statute new definitions related to deposits of public funds and allows public officials to deposit public funds in non-qualified depositories if the amounts are insured by another body that meets rating requirements. It also allows a certificate of deposit to be issued by a financial institution located outside the state. It adds to statute additional ways a depository can qualify to hold public funds. It requires financial institutions holding public funds to provide evidence of collateral. It provides the treasurer additional flexibility in determining who can be a custodian for public funds. And this bill, or the Dash 2 amendment, addresses some of the issues that were raised in a work group over the interim or prior to the session. And so the background here is that currently, the requirements to hold public funds are making it difficult for the state in some cases to engage in third-party agreements for the receipt, collection, or transfer of these funds. And so the kind of intent behind the Dash 2 amendment is to address some of those issues.
Thank you. I'm ready for a motion if someone would like to make one.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment be adopted into House Bill 2390.
Representative Finley moves the Dash 2 amendment adopted into House Bill 2390. Discussion. This is a really big amendment.
And very clear and understandable.
And we received a very full report at a previous hearing. Seems to me that our laws and systems just haven't kept up with modern technology and modern payment methods. I bet there is more than one of us that's used a credit card somewhere to pay a vendor, a micro business, or even a brick and mortar enterprise, and the business used Square or one of those other kinds of payment methods. But what happens if you pay at an outdoor recreation site, like a swimming pool or something, and use that kind of a vendor? Does it work or does it not? The set of solutions described in this bill definitely work. I just hope that there is a continued discussion to yield a simpler and systematic approach. I would like to reduce the need for identifying individual and separate agreements, for example, which seem to be a feature of some of the solutions set in this bill. And I hope that the discussions will include the balancing of the level of assumed risk with the imposing of requirements on individual businesses to comply with state regulations. I expect and hope that there will be a work group to seek advice and suggestions from far and wide. I think it's clear that we have more work to do to recognize and take actions to continue to modernize our laws and processes in the spirit of commerce as it is today, not just back to 2000 or 2010. I would like it to look forward to 2020 and beyond. I'm hoping that the work group would engage not only the traditional financial institutions like banks and credit unions and vendors and local governments, but also representatives of the technology sector more broadly. I would welcome hearing a discussion that does a little more thinking outside the box, that it's not only just the doers, but also the thinkers about the future. But I'm really pleased that the Treasurer's Office got this far in designing something to provide a great amount of help where it was sorely needed. We've moved the Dash 2 amendment in. Can we have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2390 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Finley moves House Bill 2390 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? Motion passes. So, who would like to carry this one? The person who's not here? No. Thank you. Representative Smith Warner is very happy to take this one on. I'm closing the work session on 2390, work session on House Bill 2978.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2978, this is the tax credit for short line railroads that's being proposed. And we do have the SMS that's up there right now has a dash 5 and a dash 7. We were unsure if we were going to get the paperwork on the dash 7, which is just a slight change to the dash 5. So that's why you see both of those up there today, along with the paperwork as well. But just as a quick reminder, refresher of what the underlying credit is and then what the changes are. Again, this is a credit being proposed for short line railroad rehabilitation costs. And the Dash 7 amendment is building upon the Dash 1 amendment, which this committee last discussed back on April 1st. But one of the key changes here in the Dash 7 is it's making a distinction. Really, there's a tier 1 and a tier 2 for this credit. And again, the credit is designed to cover 50% of the rehabilitation costs of the underlying credit, but there's also another cap on place based upon the number of miles of the Short Line Railroad in Oregon. Again, this is following based upon the federal credit that has since sunset for Short Line Railroads. So for the Tier 1, which is going to be the largest of the Short Line Railroads here in Oregon, there's a cap of $1,000 per mile of Short Line Railroad track in Oregon, and then Tier 2 is left unchanged at that $3,500 per mile. One of the other changes is we do have a process set up with the Dash 7 of preliminary certification where a railroad would propose a project to Oregon Department of Transportation. ODOT would then pre-certify those projects based upon the allowed total amount of rehabilitation costs that would be available for the credit, which is at $4 million per biennium. So if that cap is reached, there's then a prioritization process where the smallest of the short lines will get the first opportunity to receive that credit, and then you'll work your way to the larger ones based upon proportion of what's available left of the credit as you work your way up to the larger ones. And again, the Dash 7 didn't incorporate the Dash 1 language, which was making changes to having ODOT be the certifier rather than Department of Revenue, and some other changes that came up to make the credit work more smoothly than the introduced version. Again, we do have the paperwork on this one. It's going to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. The fiscal statement is minimal, and the revenue impact statement you can see up there in OLIS starts out at about $1 million per year, and then eventually by 23-25 biennium, you're at $3 million is what we're expecting. Biennium, for the full biennium of 23-25. The first biennium is only that one tax year, so that's why it's about half, and we do have a little bit of a ramp up as we expect more to be able to take this credit. Again, there is a carry forward provision with this credit, so if a short line doesn't have the tax liability to take the credit in 1 year, they can then carry that forward, and that's why we'd also expect a little bit more use in those outer years as those carry forwards begin to kick in a little bit.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple things. Number one, knowing that there's a cap on the credit as well, is it kind of a dollar for dollar, like how, you know, some other credits, it's you get an X percentage of what you spent. Can you, and I may have just missed that and you're talking about it, is there a percentage or is it just the cap overall, like the first whatever you spend that is certified by ODOT qualifies for it?
Yeah, Representative Smith-Warner, the credit itself is 50% is the least of those two. So that's the first test.
Something.
And then it could be less than that, certainly based on the number of miles as well. So at the most, it's a dollar-for-dollar match of the credit.
50%.
50% of your cost. We'll give you a credit for 50% of that. So if you spend $100, the credit would be $50.
Okay, great. And then number two, the interplay with the federal one, do we have specific language in here about that, just to reconfirm that for the record?
Yes, Representative, we do have language in the bill where you wouldn't be able to use the federal credit for the same rehabilitation costs as you're using the Oregon one. And that also covers grants as well, because a lot of times these railroads are getting grants to do this type of thing. So if you're getting grants for the rehabilitation costs, those wouldn't be included. And we try to get the language right so that if you're getting, let's say, a 50% or a 75% grant, you can't then use that additional 25% to then claim the credit, because if you, to get that grant, you had to match some amount, some dollar for dollar or something along those lines. You can't then use the remaining amount for this credit.
Great, thank you. And then my last question, if I may, Madam Chair, is could you talk through again the whole kind of prioritization of, because it's a limited amount, and how you, is it that, so with the Oregon Opportunity Grant, for example, we have a limited pot of money, and in the past, some of the things we've tried to do policy-wise are, it used to be first come, first serve, and we found that that disadvantaged the folks who you would think would need it the most, the lower income folks, folks for whom it could be more transformative to actually allow you to get to college. So that we have done some policy work to try to shift that so that it actually, everybody's applications come in at once and then you prioritize it based on need, so you don't give it. Is that similar to how we're trying to do this? And if you could just kind of talk that through one more time.
Yeah, Representative, yeah, that was part of the idea with the pre-certification as well through Department of Transportation, is the short lines would put in their projects, and because we do have a biennium cap, the short line would know whether or not they're going to get preliminary certified. And if you get preliminary certified, then you're going to be in line. The expectation is you would get it, because ODOT will check. Everybody puts in their applications by a certain date, and this would be in ODOT rules. And then they know, well, we're below the cap or maybe we're above it. And if we're above it, then they'll do that prioritization to the smaller of the railroads. And they will know, the short lines, the idea was they would know before they actually go and spend the money whether or not there's going to be a credit there to help them offset those costs. So they would do that prioritization in the preliminary certification. So the short line should know ahead of time how that's going to work. And yeah, the idea right now is you're prioritizing the tier two, which is all but the largest of the railroads. And even the first prioritization is for those tier two, which would include the publicly owned railroads as well. Anything below 75 miles is kind of gets the first shot. So those short lines that are 75 miles or smaller here in Oregon get the first shot of the credit. And then if there's still credit available after that, they would go to the next tier two, and then subsequently finally to the tier one, which is the largest railroads over, I think it was 200 miles.
Great.
And that's the one change in the dash seven from the dash five, if anyone's trying to find that, is it was initially that prioritization started at 50 miles, it became 75 miles.
Great.
That's page five, line 11.
Thank you.
One change.
Representative Marsh and then Representative Reschke.
Thank you. I just have two questions of clarification. I thought I heard you say it was a $3 million per biennium, but I think the revenue impacts us. The proposal is $4 million per biennium.
Yeah, Representative Marsh, the revenue impact estimate we have, the cap itself is $4 million per biennium.
Right.
So we're expecting to stay under the cap. Right. Certainly initially, and that's why the revenue loss estimate there, 2325, so the outer biennium, is 3.2 million. So we're, and part of that reason is it's the 50% of your costs mm-hmm. is what can get the credit, and then you also have that limit per mile. So in that way, there is almost a limit in place based upon those per miles. If every railroad was going for this to their max every single year, then that cap comes into play. But we had different caps were proposed in different amendments of lower amounts, and that's where if you put the cap at $1 million, you would see the revenue impact just hit that million because we think we would get there, and then you would start prioritizing. But based upon the information that we've had of past spending and things of that nature, we don't see it hitting the cap right now. But again, that cap is there to...
The cap is present.
Yeah.
And then second question of clarification, when you were responding to questions from Rep. Smith Warner regarding the federal tax credit, is there language in the bill that requires that the federal tax credit be the first place that people go?
No, Representative Marsh, it does not. It's just more if you take the federal credit, you can't then take it for the same cost here in Oregon. And that's, again, the federal credit right now has sunset. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to some of Oregon's delegation to see if we could find any information on whether they thought it was going to come back or not. And it's unknown at this time. There seemed like there was quite a bit of support. But one of the things that came up is the credit maybe at the federal level could come back. If they eliminated the sunset, it might come back at a diminished level as well. And that's where it could be one of those where if the federal credit right now, Oregon's credit is modeled after the federal credit. But if the federal credit became 20% of costs, rather than the 50%, then there could be a reason where Oregon's credit could be more beneficial. So in this case, it would really be the short line railroad would be able to choose whether to take the federal credit or the Oregon credit, but not both for the same cost. They could possibly take both credits, but for different parts of the rail line that they're rehabilitating as well. But it's all linked to the cost, so they can't double use on the same cost or the same project.
That begged another question. Then should we be looking at language in this that somehow requires them to go after whatever is available at the federal level with the ability to maybe find the balance of what the state credit is? I mean, if the federal credit is less, clearly they're going to come to the state credit. Why wouldn't you? But I want them to access those federal funds first should they become available. So is that something we should go back and look at before the next round?
So, Representative Marks, that's a policy question.
Okay.
There, one just note on the federal credit, the transferability or the way that it allows for a transfer isn't as clean or doesn't work necessarily as well as Oregon's would for, say, a public rail line. Our transferability is you can actually transfer the credit to someone who has tax liability, where the federal one, you have to almost, I think it's you designate someone who then oversees the track that can then take it. So it's a little more complicated in terms of how a public short line would be able to use the federal credit if they're both exist. There could certainly, if the federal credit came back, it could be more difficult than how Oregon's credit is structured for a public rail line to use that federal credit. So for whatever whatever that is worth in your deliberations.
Representative Rushkey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kyle, on page 5, line 11, where it's the difference between the amendments is the 50 miles and the 75 miles. Suppose there is a short line railroad that is 55 miles, and a third of that's in Oregon, and the other two-thirds might be in another state. Would the dash 50, would the dash 5 amendment, I'm trying to figure out where it, does it only count track or lease track in the state of Oregon, or is it the entire short line?
Yeah, Representative Rushkey, I'm just double-checking that it is stating short line railroad track in this state.
In this state.
So to get over that 75 miles or 50 miles, whichever one, okay. It's in this state, yes.
Thank you.
We're ready for a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that the Dash 7 amendment be adopted in House Bill 2978.
Representative Finley moves the Dash 7 amendment and adopted into House Bill 2978. Any discussion on this amendment, Dash 7? Objections? Motion passes.
This is really wrong. It's better to pay tax instead.
We'll be at ease for just a moment. It just needs to be in the screen. Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 2978 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and add a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures.
Thank you. Representative Marsh moves House Bill 2978 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. Discussion? Objections? Motion passes. That completes our work on this one. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2978, opening the work session on House Bill 2073. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2073 extends privilege taxes on merchantable forest harvested on forest lands. Essentially, we have a forest products harvest tax, and it's broken up into five different components, and those monies go to OSU Research, the Oregon Protection Fund, Forest Practices, Oregon Forest Research Institute, and then there's 10 cents that goes to another purpose with for a total of approximately $4.35. And these get updated normally every 2 years. This bill would be sent to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and the standard practice is for the Department of Forestry to determine the budget and that to be then taken and allocated to those four charges.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2073 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Finley moves House Bill 2073 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Clearly, there is a Dash 1 amendment that was posted early today to this bill. Clearly, we are not moving it. But I think it is important to note that there's obviously a lot of interest in both the collection and the distribution formula for the harvest tax. I think that the Wildfire Council that is at work currently is charged with coming back with some recommendations about how we pay for wildfire. And I think we will all be, given the amount of interest in the building on this, we'll all be really interested in the recommendations of that group when they come forward.
Thank you. Other discussion? Objections? Motion passes. And this is going to Joint Ways and Means. We don't need a carrier. We are completed with House Bill 2073. And I'm opening an informational meeting now on earned income tax credit. We can always play it later on TV.
There you go. I will.
Why is everybody leaving? They have to come down to office.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yet today, I do have a few slides up in OLS that I'm going to walk through. And this is what I have for you today is a comparison, in some cases, or a discussion, really, between the earned income tax credit here in Oregon and then the one that is available in California. And this really came out of a discussion a week ago from last Friday that happened in the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures, where there was an informational meeting on the earned income tax credit. And one of the things that came up was California had a high percentage for their earned income tax credit. It had 85%, so they looked pretty unique in that table of all the states and what their earned income tax credit is. So again, California's structure is a little bit different, so I'll just try to add a little context and some background to how California's structure is set up and how that differs from ours here in Oregon. So again, the first couple slides I have here are just the qualifications for the earned income tax credit. I don't plan to go through these, but I just wanted to put them in there as kind of a placeholder if there's any question on them again. But just as a refresher, Oregon's structure for the earned income tax credit is our credit is simply a percentage of the federal earned income tax credit. So if a taxpayer is taking the federal credit, then in Oregon you're going to either receive or you can claim a credit equal to 8% or 11% of the federal credit. And again, our 11% is for taxpayers with a dependent under the age of 3. So they get an additional 3 percentage points there for the credit. So the first chart you see in front of you here is the federal earned income tax credit. And this is just showing the structure of the earned income tax credit, and these are the federal dollar amounts. But again, the structure of the earned income tax credit is designed as a taxpayer initially increases their adjusted gross income, the amount of the credit is going up. And that's where you can see the slope of the lines going up there. Then there's a plateau period where the credit amount plateaus, so it stays the same. And then eventually, as income continues to increase, the credit phases down. And that's where you see the sloping lines down. And based upon the number of children you have depends, or the number of qualifying children depends, or it goes into the calculation of what your credit is. So as the number of children increases, the credit amount goes up. And then the dotted lines here just represent the difference between the single filers and the married filing jointly are the dotted line. But so that's the federal credit structure. Oregon's, again, it looks the same because this is just the 8% credit for simplification purposes and displaying this. But again, Oregon's credit is just simply a percentage of, so we have the same ramp up, plateau, and then phase down structure. California, on the other hand, while they do have that larger percent, they begin phasing it down at a much lower adjusted gross income, and they don't have a plateau. So initially, they're 85% of the federal credit, but then they hit the peak. You really just see a triangle there. There's no plateau, and then it starts facing down pretty quickly right after it hits that peak. And California only enacted this, I think it was in 2014. Most recently, in 2017, they made the change here where instead of just having effectively a triangle for 0 children, 1, 2, or 3, they now added this long tail of the phase out. So this was added first became available in tax year 2017, and that helped to get the credit in California out to more taxpayers, but at a much lower level. So it expanded it quite a bit from, I think it's like 350,000 to over 1 million people that are taking this, but at a much lower level. The next chart is just overlaying or California's earned income tax credit over Oregon. So this is the same. You can see the Oregon lines here, much smaller because the California credit is much larger initially, but it really is focused on a lower adjusted gross income tax paying group. So why it is higher, again, that focus for the California credit is really on, once you get even, it's a little bit lower than 15,000, that credit really starts to, is in that low phase out tail period. But most of the benefit at that point, or most of the credit, has phased out, and then it slowly goes away over the next 10,000 or so in income. And the chart you have here, this is pulled from some analysis that was done when California originally enacted their credit. So it's without that that longer tail period that became available in 2017. But I think this chart does a good job of displaying maybe the difference in the underlying policy of California's credit versus, say, Oregon's or any other state that just simply does a percentage of the federal, in that California really focused their credit at the lowest of the low income. So you don't get that plateau and you don't get that long phase out. So the chart you see in front of you here is a combination of the federal earned income tax credit and California's earned income tax credit back in 2015. And what you see, the same lines you've been seeing for the federal credit, Oregon's credit, you see the ramp up, the plateau, and the phase down. California's state earned income tax credit allows this ramp up to happen earlier in the adjusted gross income. So it really, you can see how that expansion or that California credit really does focus on those lower income folks. And then the federal credit more or less takes over from there in some cases. So rather than building upon the federal credit throughout the adjusted gross income spectrum, you can really see that focus is on getting more benefit to those lower income folks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Kyle. I just want to confirm right now, and both federal and California, let alone Oregon, are they refundable?
Yes.
It is refundable. Okay. Yeah. Because just when you look at the numbers, if your adjusted gross income is $10,000 and it's $6,000, that feels like either that's refundable or it seems excessive. Okay, good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
That's how they get the benefit there, that lower income level. Sure.
Thank you.
So that's, one thing that I should note also is California doesn't have a distinction between whether you're single or married filing jointly. It all has to do with the number of kids you have, but whether you're single with two kids or married filing jointly with two kids, your credit amount is the same based upon your adjusted gross income. So that's a slight distinction as well. And then this other chart is, again, this is building on some work that was done in California when they enacted it, but it's another way of viewing the same thing on the last chart. It's just you're seeing income and then percent of federal poverty level is the vertical axis. So you can see just the gray line as income goes up, you move out of what they're saying is labeled as extreme poverty. So that's 50% of the federal poverty level, 100%. And the blue shaded area here is showing the federal earned income tax credit. So that's your additional income that someone is getting through the earned income tax credit at the federal level. And then the reddish pinkish color here is that California credit. And again, you can see how that really does hit at that less than 50%, less than 100% of federal poverty level in boosting a little bit of that income at that lower income level. And again, it's the same thing that was on the last slide, but just, I guess, visualized a different way. And then the last one I have here is the chart that's up in front of you there is, this is the distribution of Oregon's earned income tax credit. And again, the distribution is gonna follow the same as with the federal level, just our amount would be less. But the amount that's in the box there, that's really where, again, California is focusing on that lower income. So your peak credit for California is about $7,500 in income, depends how many kids you have. But it's going to pretty much be phased out more or less at the $15,000 in adjusted gross income. So you're really focusing on that smaller amount of the distribution. It's about 30% or so of taxpayers that are claiming their income tax credit now would be benefiting from, say, the California credit. So it's just, again, it's kind of keeping with that theme there of how they were, what their policy decision, I suppose, was to really direct those funds at the lower income folks. And in terms of just a use comparison, I found some numbers from California of tax year 2018. They're at about, this is after their change of that slow phase down too, that really expanded the numbers, out to about 1.4 million returns, close to $350 million, and an average of $250 That compares to Oregon, where we're at about 250,000 returns, 46 million total, an average of 186. And again, the California average was much higher before they did that expansion. It was, I think, 350, 400,000 returns in, say, 2016 before they made that change to really allow that low phase down where they're essentially giving a small credit to quite a few, another 700,000 or 800,000 taxpayers that are getting a pretty small credit compared to the initial high one that California has for the lowest of low income. And this is just kind of a summary of the points I just made. The one thing I didn't go over here is the last bullet there is the California Earned Income Tax Credit does work within their budget process as well. So it's one of those things where, and I'm not super familiar on this, it's almost like they go through their review process in some way that our legislature has every 6 years where they have to think about what they're going to be spending on their Earned Income Tax Credit each time they go through the budget process. And if they allocate nothing in the budget process, by default goes to zero, their kind of adjustment factor. So it builds it in, I guess, in whether it's a biennial or an annual process. It's just something that's more out in front each time. So that's another, I suppose, key difference with what they're doing. But other than that, that's kind of my high level overview. And then happy to take any questions.
Representative Marsh.
Well, I just want to express my thanks for that. That was a terrific analysis that you pulled together very quickly since we discussed it, I think, only a week and a half ago. I know that this concept of focusing on the very lowest income gives the advocates some heartburn because it has an impact on people just above that level. But I think over time, it's really something that we should look at to say, does it make more sense to invest deeply and the most needy Oregonians, as opposed to spreading a benefit out. I don't think that's something we can resolve in this session, but I do think it's a discussion we should be having. So thank you.
Any other discussion? Following up on Representative Marsh's comments, I can think of a number of questions that wouldn't necessarily be for Legislative Revenue Office, but perhaps for some of the advocates and social service organizations and others who advocate for EITC. Who is being helped, and what difference did that amount of help make? Sometimes a little bit of money is very useful and necessary, and in other cases, it didn't make enough difference. And if you thought about the power of all of those small pieces of money and could invest them in another way in larger amounts to fewer people, would that have been more helpful? I feel like these are very serious questions to ponder and not something to take on lightly. This is really very helpful. I want to echo Representative Marsh's thanks for preparing that for us. We have a lot more we would need to think about before changing our system. Anything else? That concludes our informational meeting. There's no other business before us today. We're adjourned. Mm-hmm.